Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. It is a real treat to have Lou Burney with me here today talking about his wonderful new book, Dark Ride. I've really been looking forward to talking with you about this book.
So thanks so much, Patrick. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I wish I was there in person. It's one of my favorite bookstores anywhere. So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And thanks also for signing a batch of books for us. So we've got, Lou kindly signed a whole bunch of copies of Dark Ride. And I'll put a link if I can maneuver. I'm kind of flying solo today. So if I can put it in the comments field. Otherwise, you all know how to get in touch with us. It's just store.poisonedpen.com. And we have signed copies. But Lou, yeah, it's really great. It's been a little while, been a minute since your last book. Before we get into this book, tell us how have the last very strange, surreal years been for you?
Yeah, it's funny. My last book came out in 2018, and I spent about two and a half years working on a new novel, and it just really wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't coming together, and it was kind of killing me. It was just really hurting. And so right around when COVID hit, I guess it would have been March 2020, I was like, you know what? Life's too short. I need to start something brand new and something I like writing. And that was Dark Ride. And it clicked immediately for me. And it's a book and a character I fell in love with right away. So I think in some ways I have the pandemic to thank for that, for just a reset of my thinking. So
is that manuscript that you started, is it something that's salvageable and something you might go back to at some point?
Yeah, I think so. Like with writing, sometimes you just get too close to something and you miss the forest for the trees, you know, is the cliche, but it's really true. And so I think I will go back to that one at some point. And I have a hunch I'll see a lot of the solutions to it that were just eluding me at the time because I was too close to it.
Right. Right now with Dark Ride, what an interesting approach to writing a novel. There's so much going on here that I want to talk to you about. Although our lead, Hardy Reed, is definitely the protagonist in the story, it's very much an ensemble cast, you know, with this great crew of kind of misfits. I really love the cast that you put together. Can you kind of set up who Hardy is and maybe the opening sequence that gets the story kicked off?
Right. Hardly. His nickname is Hardly, and that describes him well because he's a 21-year-old guy floating through life, just trying to remain as effortless as possible. He's kind of a stoner and a slacker, working minimum wage jobs. He's a scare actor at a kind of second rate amusement park, Fright Zone. And he just kind of doesn't want to get involved or connected with anything. He just is sort of floating along. And then one day he happens to be at the municipal offices taking care of a parking ticket. And he sees two little kids on a bench by themselves. And he's a really good-hearted guy. So he goes over to check to make sure they're okay. And he notices they have signs of potential abuse, that someone might be hurting them. And so he tries to report this to someone. He goes to Child Protective Services. No one will listen to him, or they're too overwhelmed, understaffed, overworked to do anything about it. So in the end, he feels compelled to sort of take on this job himself to try to figure out what's happening to those kids and try to help them.
And he undergoes, as do several characters in the book, quite a transformation, you know. It's almost like he makes the transition from a young man into an adult in this book in a lot of ways. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. And I was thinking, like, with this character, I liked him right away, and I kind of realized at some point he was the last person you would ever think to be the main character of a crime novel. And then I wanted to see if he'd be able to grow into that role. And part of the book for me was just trying to figure out if he would. Like, I was in some ways a spectator waiting to see if he would be able to get his head above water and actually help these kids. And becoming, you know, an adult, becoming a member of a community, becoming the kind of person who is active and not passive. All those sorts of things are going on for this character, which to me are really kind of interesting ideas.
Was there any, what kind of set this particular story in motion for you? Was there something that you came across, or was there a personal story that, what can you tell?
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned, I've spent 2.5 years working on a book that was a disaster. And so I kind of, when I came up with Hardly, I was writing what I knew, which was like someone who's kind of incompetent and in over their heads, because that's the way I felt at the time. And I felt like I need to finish this book. It's my career. It's what I love to do. And I'm failing at it. And so I wanted Hardly to be the same kind of way, that he really desperately wants to help these kids. He just doesn't know how, and he's got to figure it out. And so a lot of this came from the old adage, write what you know.
But with the deal with the kids, was there any kind of particular story in the background that...
I had read some stuff in the past. It's one of those kind of things where you read an article, you know, years earlier, and it just sort of spins around in the back of your mind and sticks with you. And I remember long, long ago reading an article about a security guard at I think it was a courthouse, who noticed a kid who he thought might be abused, and no one would listen to him. And that just always stuck to me, is that, like, what would you do in that situation? And so I think, you know, once I had Hardly, that idea bubbled to the surface, and the two connected in a way that I had never anticipated before.
And the two kids, you know, when we first get a glimpse of them, they have that kind of shell-shocked look to them, you know, just kind of almost like fixed. Some of those details seem very, very authentic. Tell me a little bit about the research into this whole underworld. It must have been kind of a dark ride.
The research was tough. I mean, it's, yeah. I think the biggest shock to me was doing the research and realizing just how big of a problem this is in the United States, that Child Protective Services in every state, in every county practically, is underfunded and overwhelmed, understaffed. Most of their employees come and go very quickly. And there's just a ton of kids falling through the cracks. And not all of them are abused, but, you know, all of them need help. And a lot of them aren't getting that help. And it's something that you don't hear people talk about very much. They talk about sort of flashier stuff, like, you know, child trafficking, which is a problem, I get. It's absolutely a problem. But there's something going on right under our noses in every city, in every state, in every county. And that's what really struck me, is just how big of a problem and an issue this is, and how people really need to step up and do something about this.
People don't know exactly what to do. You know, with Hardly, you know, at the beginning of the book, he has the idea, which probably is shared by a lot of us, that, okay, I'll just call CPS. They'll send somebody out, assess the situation. The kids will be placed in a safer environment. Everything will be great. You know, I think he at the beginning of the book, he had that thought. You know, this is the extent of my involvement. This is what I'm going to have to do. And quickly, it turns out that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something all of us, it's a natural human instinct in part, like, I, you know, to say like, oh, someone else will take care of this problem. And for me, I think I put this in the book. I worked it in as part of Hardly's mother. But my dad, I remember growing up, he would stop for every broken down car on the road. He would stop for every person that needs help. You know, I'm like, I can't count the times in my childhood when we're like pulling over, or we're like going in a store or helping someone. Like, my dad always just felt kind of responsible, like personally, like, okay, there's a problem here. Like, I'm not going to rely on someone else. I'm going to see what I can do. And I think that's a quality I value so highly. And so I wanted that to be part of who Hardly became and who Hardly was.
Right. And we learn, you know, a little bit about his own background, you know, growing up in a foster family. And he had I thought it was really well done that you made him have a positive, mostly positive experience. I think maybe having him have a horrific experience would have been too much, don't you?
Yeah, I try to always avoid the cheesiness of some kind of stories where it just lines up too neatly. And I just like the idea that Hardly, yeah, he was in foster care, but he had a fairly decent experience. at the same time, though,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. But at the same time, that had an effect on him because he didn't really have a family, and so I kind of tried to have my cake and eat it too with his background.
Yeah, he has his kind of benign neglect, I guess.
Right. Know? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and he, you know, from the very beginning, we see what a, you know, what a big heart he has, and what a sense of compassion that he has. Early on, it's funny, I was mentioning that the basic setup that you just said to my wife, you know, we're talking a little bit about it. And, you know, I love the device where he goes in and he's trying to get the people at the government court office to pay attention to him. And Eleanor, the great, the goth chick, which we can talk about, you know, she's like, you really need to sign in. He's like, what? You know, she's like, no, you really need to sign in. And of course, that's how he gets the name of the woman that they couldn't legally tell him.
Right.
Again, folks, I'm not giving away too much. This is the very beginning of the book. But he goes, you know, he and this wonderful crew, as I say, of misfits, which we'll get into in more detail, you know, he goes off on this investigation and he finds that he is naturally suited to it. Is that fair to say? Or
yeah, not at first though, as you point out. It takes him a while. Like, I mean, it was fun to write it at the beginning because usually when you write a crime novel, you're writing about a character who's smarter than you a lot of times, if it's a detective or an investigator. And so you're like, okay, what would someone smarter than me do? And with Hardly, it was like, what would I do? Or what would someone even dumber than me do? And so at the beginning, Hardly makes a lot of mistakes, you know, and does things that I hope the reader's going, oh my God, why did you do that? But then slowly he does discover he's got sort of a natural talent for this that he never realized he had.
Right. Tell us a little bit about this this broken down, raggedy ass amusement park that he works in. Was this based on a real place?
Well, kind of here in Oklahoma City, where I live, which is the setting of the book, although it's never stated, there's been an amusement park for years and years, like 60, 70 years, called Frontier City. And I have like fond memories of a kid going there. And it's kind of at times in its history been pretty rattle trap. And so that was always in the back of my head. I wanted to give him a job that had some potential for thematic resonance and just for some interesting backdrops. Like I'm always looking for opportunity. And so it just seemed like that'd be a fun job for him to have as, you know, sort of the dead sheriff as a zombie who kind of shows the crowd through this haunted fright zone.
And there's the, I love it. The abandoned mine train, you know, is a big setting in the book, you know, where kind of the secret place where, you know, he goes and kind of regroups and hangs out.
Right. And that's the dark ride of the title.
Exactly.
Right. Which I was, that's funny. That's my wife's favorite line in the book was the ride is the abandoned mine train, but it's abandoned. So it's the abandoned mine train. So right. I'm glad someone else liked it. So thanks.
Yeah, no, that was great. So when he's kind of so the basic setup, you know, obviously he's investigating and he has this wonderful, one of my favorite characters in the book is Salvador, this 16-year-old kind of also sort of a misfit sidekick, protege almost. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite characters too. And I'm not sure where he came from, but he just emerged out of whole cloth for me. And he's kind of this guy who worships Hardly, and Hardly is kind of embarrassed by it because Hardly recognizes that there's nothing about him to worship. And Salvador is 16. He's picked on by everybody but Hardly. And Hardly is the one who's like kind to him and grudgingly allows him to tag along. And Salvador's got kind of an arc too in the book. You know, I think, you know, the two sort of parallel each other.
Yes.
That, you know, as Hardly starts to evolve, Salvador does too. And I wanted that to be kind of an interesting element. And to me, it's just, I guess I would say, like with Salvador, he's the guy with a lot of potential who can go a lot of different ways. Same with Hardly. And that's what the book was interesting to me. It was a good book to write for me because I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know how these characters would end up. And I always think that's best for the reader when the writer is not even really aware of that themselves. And with these guys, I knew from the beginning that a good heart might not be enough to pull this off, but it might be. And I was just like, that was the question that was always in my head.
Right. And then you got this great character, Felice Upton, the real estate agent, former PI. Where does she come from and how does she fit in?
Man, I'm so glad you're calling attention to the other characters, because I really love and spend a lot of time on these secondary characters. As you said, it's really an ensemble piece to a lot of degrees. Felice is this, you know, traditionally in crime fiction, there's sort of a mentor character. If you're an amateur sleuth, you meet someone who's going to show you the ropes. And so I wanted to like embrace that idea, but I also wanted to subvert it in certain ways. And so I made Felice a very reluctant kind of person in terms of trying to help Hardly or what she wanted from Hardly. And she's not even a PI anymore. She's a real estate agent. So I wanted their relationship to be really complicated and interesting. And I wanted her to kind of be also the voice of the reader at times, telling Hardly, like, you need to stop this. This is dumb. This is a bad idea.
That's interesting. That didn't occur to me, but of course. Yeah. And there's a lot of the little nuances in their conversation that I found really interesting, you know, about, you know, how she would never really answer a direct question, you know, in this very sort of way of getting information out of him without revealing anything of herself. You know, these sort of techniques that she is sort of teaching him in a way of...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I'm so glad you picked up on that, because that was kind of I wanted to be this mentorship and this education, but it's almost like she doesn't really want to teach him. He's picking it up on his own. And that's where he starts to discover his own kind of natural affinity for paying attention, which was one of her big pieces of advice early on, is just, you just got to pay attention. And he realizes that when he focuses, he can pay attention. And this idea that it's, you know, she's a woman in her mid-40s, an African-American woman in her mid-40s, and he's this white stoner dude who's 21. I wanted it to be as much of a potential clash as possible, so that the relationship that evolved, you know, had a real organic meaning to it.
There's a bit of Mrs. Robinson in there too.
yeah, for sure. Yeah,
and what's funny is that, and I thought this was really great, is that she doesn't involve herself in the case too much. You know, I mean, he's the one that's doing all the legwork, him and his gang. Right.
Yeah. I always like with crime fiction, I love the tropes and I love the conventions. And I'm also always trying to push against them a little bit and throw a little bit of a surprise at the reader. And so I wanted to think about what would really happen. And Felice wants something out of this relationship, but she also definitely is not going to do anything stupid. You know, I just don't want her doing stupid for the sake of the book. And I see that too many times in crime novels where a character is like kind of acting at the whim of the author rather than what the character would really do. And Felice is not going to get involved in this stuff. She's too smart, but you know, she's interested in Hardly and likes him, if, you know, genuinely. So she gets pulled in just enough to give him a boost, I think.
Well, she's kind of the, you know, obviously the much more experienced, worldly, I hate to say world weary, because she doesn't really seem that way. But she, at least the way I read it, she identifies his decency, you know, and his inherent goodness, even though he's sort of the somewhat naive and experienced guy, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what, I mean, I think that's what happens with all the characters in the book. Like, I think Eleanor's that way. And I think the mother, Tracy, not to give anything away, is that way. I think there's this recognition that this is a decent guy. This is like a good-hearted guy that kind of disarms people who would never in a million years like lower their guard.
Right. And there are points throughout the book where he keeps you know, when he's going through some, you know, some challenge, or when he gets his ass kicked, you know, his first thought is not to himself. His first thought is to those kids. And it keeps going back to it. It's like, you know, I may feel shitty now, or, you know, but what about those kids? They're trapped, you know, they're trapped in this, and they have no outlet. So it keeps coming back to the kids throughout the book.
Yeah, he can't get rid of that. He's haunted by it, to go back to sort of the idea of his day job. You know, he is someone like, he would love to say, I don't want to do this, I give up, I quit. He would love to do that, but he can't. He's literally trapped himself because he has to help these kids. He can't live with the thought of them being in the situation that they're in. And I think, again, that's a sign of a really good heart. And it's what drives him, you know, for better or worse, into some dangerous situations.
So what can you tell readers about, you know, obviously we've set up the book, but about the investigation and how it progresses and, you know, that kind of thing. Is there much that we can really say?
Well, I mean, I think the idea was, I was thinking about, okay, Hardly first has to figure out some very basic stuff, like who are the parents of these two kids, and right, and he has to confirm that something bad is happening to them. So there's just a very basic level of gumshoe work that he has to do, and then he learns to do with Salvador, you know, just figuring out how to go through Facebook and identify photos from different elementary schools and figure out where they go to school so he can find a name. I mean, there's just a lot of that he's not used to working that hard, and he kind of has to like learn to do that. And then he just gets deeper and deeper with his discoveries, where he discovers that things are even more dangerous than he thought. And there's a lot going on, and it's sort of like he's taking a step forward, but then discovering there's a like even steeper obstacle right in front of him now. And then like, as he grows, so do the obstacles. That was kind of my idea with the book, that he gets better, but everything gets tougher for him too.
And, you know, he finds out obviously who the parents are. Let's see. So the father is a lawyer. We discover early on. Again, this is very early in the book when he discovers this. But yeah, those basic details, it a lot of that early gumshoe stuff does seem very analog. Although you mentioned the Facebook, you know, and getting Salvatore, who's, what is he, 6 years younger, and there's already a huge, you know, gap in technology, you know.
Yeah, I wanted them kind of being the blind leading the blind in a way. Like, I set it up that Hardly is really analog. Like, he plays video games and he's got a phone, but he stays off social media. He's too lazy to learn TikTok, you know. I mean, he's just like, right, too much hassle, man. So when he has to like figure stuff out, he's relying on Salvatore, who doesn't really know what he's doing either. I think there's one moment in the book where Salvador is really excited because he has a way to find people, and his secret way to find people. And he explains it's called Google. And Hardly's just like, what are you doing, man? But he still keeps working with Hardly.
Put the name in quotes, man.
That's right. This is early in the book. They get better. You know, they definitely improve, but you're always wondering, like, I mean, for me as a writer, I was like, no, you guys should not be involved with this. Like find someone who knows what they're doing. So I was always tense writing this book.
Well, and he also, you know, he also, I think, I don't want to speak for you, but he also realizes that, you know, the crew of kind of, you know, stoners that he'd been fellow slackers that he'd been hanging out with, there wasn't really a deep bond, you know, like Nguyen and Mallory, right? Those crew.
Yeah, that was something that kind of came up as I was writing this idea that Hardly doesn't really have genuine connections in his life. Like, his fellow stoners, they just sit and watch reruns of The Office all day and get stoned. And they're friends technically, but they don't really have much of a connection. And all of a sudden, in the course of this investigation, Hardly is developing real relationships, like with Eleanor, with Felice, with Salvador. And that's the first time in his life he's felt connected to the world. And so that's partly what drives him too, is like, he feels like he's got a place in the world that he didn't have before. And I think that's, I mean, he's got multiple motivations, the kids being the strongest one, but I think it also feels really good to him to be connected to human beings that he's genuine friends with now.
Right. It's funny because, you know, it, as the book progresses, it's always a series of choices that he's making. You know, some of them are bad, some of them are decent. And, but we see kind of, you know, he has this thing, this sort of instinct, maybe I should cut my hair. Maybe that would, you know, make me able to fit into this world a little bit easier, look more respectable, you know, and sort of the, you know, he doesn't give up smoking weed, but it goes a little bit by the wayside. He's not smoking it as much, you know, he's finding his own kind of his own confidence and his own power. And some of these things are just kind of falling to the wayside.
Right, exactly. I mean, I'm so glad you know it picked up. Yeah, I totally love that you picked that up, because that's what I was going for. I didn't want to make it too extreme that all of a sudden he changes overnight, but I wanted him to change substantially and kind of meaningfully. And the big thing is, like, you know, you read the book, you realize, wow, this guy is working hard, like, for anybody, by any standards, by halfway through, by the second, two thirds. And he's a guy who started out working as little as possible, but then all of a sudden he's a guy getting up early in the morning and doing like a full long day of work. And that's something that, you know, he would have never imagined for himself, I think.
Right. Right. And there is, you know, in the background of this book is, you know, there's a lot of addiction, you know, talk about addiction going on, and how addiction dovetails with CPS and so on and so forth. Is there anything we can say without giving?
I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, it is something I wanted to make it as complex as possible and as authentic as possible. And so when I was approaching this, again, there's nothing graphic, there's nothing gruesome, there's nothing gratuitous about the violence in this book whatsoever when it comes to the kids.
It's all off screen, really.
Yeah. And I just didn't, that wasn't interesting to me at all. I didn't think that's what the book was about. But I did want to make it like, you know, I wanted Hardly to try to see things from as many perspectives as possible. And I wanted him to recognize that there's just not good and evil in the world. There is evil, but there's also this gray area in between that lets evil thrive. And that's a trickier thing to deal with.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've had an experience, in, you know, myself with, a friend of mine, who was, he was a heroin addict, and, you know, he was in this horrible relationship with this woman, and these two kids were kind of caught in the crossfire, you know, and, we tried to get CPS involved and then felt horrible about it, you know, and it's just so hard to know what the right thing is to do. You know, you don't know if they're going to be put into a worse environment or
right.
And then, you know, you come to find out that, you know, the CPS had been involved much earlier, which we didn't realize, but that their definition of what is a stable environment is not quite as the same as mine, you know, my own privileged, you know, sort of
right.
suburban, you know, outlook. So,
right.
So right. No, it was very much of an eye opener, you know, and you get into that system, and luckily the kids are now over 18 and they're off doing their own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a complex, and I mean, there's not an easy answer. I mean, one clear answer is these agencies need to be better funded, for sure. And they need better staffing. I mean, there's a lot of burnout just because imagine doing that job. I mean, I can't imagine doing that job. And so they need, you know, they need training, they need support that they're in a lot of places just aren't getting right now.
Yeah. And I'm sure all of them have something or maybe multiple things that they've seen that they can never unsee, you know, and it kind of almost like any cop or, you know, yeah. On a happier note, tell me about Vamoose.
Vamoose. Oh yeah,
that.
I'm glad
I
you
love
like
that,
that
so
too.
much.
Oh, I love that you love that, Patrick. That's one. That's another one of my favorite. My wife's favorite things is we were actually getting our COVID shots at a Walgreens or a CVS, I think. And you know, you had to wait for a little bit for the pharmacist to come out. So we were standing against the wall of, you know, lotions and unguents and potions for skin. And one of the things was Vamoose, which is a lice removal shampoo. And it's Vamoose spelled M-O-U-S-S-E, which I just love the pun of that. It just cracked me up. And I thought, you know what? That's going to bring Eleanor and Hardly together, that they both think that's funny.
Yeah, no, I love that. And yeah, Eleanor, the goth girl that we meet early on, we haven't really talked too much about her, but how does she fit into this mix? She's just another different type of outsider. You know, she's very protective of herself, of her space, and she has a defense up to keep people out, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think with all the secondary characters, they're all kind of loners in the same way that Hardly was. And they're all kind of outcasts, misfits. And like watching them come together and work together in kind of a haphazard way sometimes was really interesting to me. And watching the walls come down for each of the characters, and kind of, I felt like it had sort of it was kind of contagious in a way. Like as Hardly opened up, Eleanor found it a little bit easier to open up to him, and these people started to sort of thrive in a way that they hadn't before.
Right, right. And there was, it's funny because there is something about this, and I don't want to overstate the case, but there is something that there's a bit of the hero's journey in this, in a sense of the sort of the classic trip that he goes out on.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's that one point, you know, halfway or two-thirds through the novel where he realizes that he's changed, and he realizes that he can't go back, you know, and he kind of tries. He tries to kind of hang out with old friends and, you know, smoke weed and all that stuff, but it's already, you know, the ball's in motion and there's no going back. He says, yeah, this is the first, I think it's on page 104, if you're reading at home. This is the first time in my life I realize that I'm a different person, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think for him, it's such an eye opener because like I came from a family that didn't have much money, but I had very supportive parents and sisters who were always encouraging me to do whatever I wanted to do, like be what I could be. It was like very like, you can be that, you can do that. Hardly comes from after his mom dies, completely different world where he's hearing the opposite message basically. And so for him to discover that, like, man, I can be somebody different in a positive way is really a shock or a revelation. And that's something that's hard to walk back from.
And then his brother, Preston, oh man, he was great too. We didn't really talk about him. How does Preston fit into this?
Preston's his former foster brother, and it really is only family he has. Like they stay in touch. They can't stand each other. But
Preston's
again,
black. He's white.
Yeah. Preston's a go-getter. He works for the city council. I mean, he's a hard worker. He's got a house and a fiance, and he thinks Hardly's a slacker, and Hardly thinks Preston's, you know, a drip. And but they're as much brothers as any real brothers are, and I think that kind of connection, you know, Hardly comes to see Preston in a different light, and Preston sees Hardly in a different light, and so I feel like by the end, that's a relationship that has evolved in a really positive way.
Definitely, getting back to the amusement park just for a moment.
Which is awesome because that was one of my favorite things to write. I loved writing those chapters.
Sure.
So, yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah, who doesn't love a, you know, kind of a slightly seedy, you know, we have a yearly carnival that comes to town in downtown Phoenix, and it's actually going on right now, and they're building it. But you know, we always like to walk over there, and there's something kind of seedy in the background always, you know,
right
places. Did you know people that worked at the local one, or did you have?
Well, I called one. First of all, I should say I made up almost all that stuff. Like, I had so much fun making up, like, okay, what would be at this fright zone? I've never been to a fright zone, so I'm too much of a chicken. I'm not going to a fright zone. You're not getting me to research that. So I made up all this stuff that was at the fright zone, like the graves and the squeezing the eyeball and the hanged man. I figured that'd be cool. But I did call, I did track down a gunfighter at Frontier City to sort of ask him some tips on various things about the ins and outs of the park and working there. So that was interesting conversation.
Did you ever happen to read, I love the Carney stuff. Did you ever read Nightmare Alley?
No, I saw the movie. I never read the book though.
The book is really something. It's something that you don't, you know, it's a lot of things that you don't, you know, at first think it's going to be. It's one of the best books about alcoholism I've ever read.
Oh, really? Oh, I definitely got to read that then. I didn't realize the book was that good. So I got to check that out.
It's really something. Yeah. So
I've read the book. Have you read the book Geek Love by Katherine Dunn?
I never have. I've heard nothing. Is it good?
Yeah, it's sort of looking at that behind the curtain, very seamy, disturbing side of the carnival life, and it's fascinating.
I'll have to read that. I've always heard about it.
Yeah. I've got a sideshow poster in my banner in my living room. Since I was a kid, I've been fascinated with sideshows and carnivals and the Oklahoma State Fair and the gritty, seedy, dangerous world of all that.
It's fascinating. So did you grow up in Oklahoma?
I did. I grew up in Oklahoma City and then left when I was 18 to go to college, and didn't really lived in California, New Orleans, Massachusetts, bunch of places before coming back to Oklahoma City about 20 years ago as an adult. And we've been here. My wife and I have been here since then.
Wow. Do you know, I'm sure you probably do, Joe Lansdale?
Sure. Yeah. His stuff is fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful writer. And
yeah,
kind of like what you're describing. I mean, that Nacogdoches, East Texas, mm-hmm. was kind of the one of the crossroads for a lot of the traveling carny shows and revivals, you know.
Yeah, revivals, the revival circuit, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. And so all that, yeah. you know he grew up in the 50s and 60s, so you know, all that is kind of jumbled up with drive-in horror movies and science
yep.
fiction. And then yeah. I love that.
Yeah, I remember going to this. The drive-in was literally like three blocks from our house growing up, and I remember walking up there every, you know, weekend night, and like at age 6 or 7, and sneaking in and watching these movies that I shouldn't be seeing probably. But speaking of locations, I do want to point out that it just occurred to me that my new novel that I'm working on, I'm about 300 pages into it. Part of it is set in Scottsdale, and which comes from my earlier visits to Poison Pen. I was like, oh yeah, you know, I'm gonna put it in Scottsdale because you guys are kind of on the edge of the frontier too. You know, like two hours west of Scottsdale, and you're in no man's land to some degree. So true. I love that.
It's true. The city's sort of metastasizing outward, and you know, but yes, it's there's still a lot of really interesting places to go to here. I've been thinking about you know, my wife and I have been considering, although it's probably too late now, there's a little community, and I shouldn't say it on the damn stream because community just about an hour, maybe an hour and a half directly east, called Miami. Miami and Globe and Superior are these three really interesting, to my way of thinking, old mining towns. And people are buying up these old mining properties on the cheap. We have some friends who bought a former bordello in Miami.
No way. That's fantastic.
Yeah. You know, it's got like, it's two story and the rooms are exactly the same size, you know.
Right.
You know what they're all used for. But yeah, they bought it for like pennies on the dollar, and they're busy fixing it up. I think it's probably too late now. But
that sounds fantastic, man. I'm either going to go buy property there, or I'm going to use it in my novel, or both. That's thanks for the tip.
You bet.
That sounds fantastic. A former bordello. How can you beat that? That's fantastic.
No, it's awesome. I guess there's a whole row of them that kind of go up because the miners needed their, you know, their entertainment. And
Right.
So let's see here. We still got plenty of time. Tell me a little bit about the portrait of the artist as a young man. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer, or was that something that came later? Or?
Well, I have two older sisters who are 10 and 11 years older than me. And from a very early age, they taught me to read and write. They wanted to be teachers. So that's what they did. They're like, we're going to teach you whether you like it or not. So from a very early age, I love books. I love writing. I love making stories up. And I think it really hit me the hardest in high school when I remember I liked to make stories up. I loved to read. And then I did a story for the school newspaper and I saw my byline, my name in print. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And from then on, I kind of thought like, man, I want to see that name in print more than once. And that was a little bit of a boost as well. So yeah, I think for a long time, being a writer, I'm like kind of a natural born liar, but I also have a good heart. So combining those two things, there's not a lot of like legitimate paths you can go on. So writing was a pretty good choice for me. Writing fiction was.
Well, that's cool that you can own that you have a good heart. You know, a lot of people can't do that.
I try. I should say I try. That's the thing about the book. A good heart might not be enough, you know, unless you sort of take action or have something to back it up. And to me, that's sort of one of the kind of the philosophical conundrums of this book to a degree, I think.
Mm. Right. Now, so your last book, 2018, that was November Road, correct?
Right.
And that got an awful lot of attention. And, you know, one of the things I admire about your stuff is that you never repeat yourself. And, you know, everything's different each time.
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily by design. It's just kind of like where my interests lie. And I know as a reader, I love all different sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And I read all different sorts of things. And I think it just comes from like, all right, I've done that. What can I do that's new and fresh and original and keeps me engaged? Because I'm a big believer that if the writer's not engaged, the audience will not be engaged. And so that's kind of my search for that always. And the great thing about crime fiction, I mean, you know better than anybody, Patrick, about crime fiction right now, is it's such a big tent. There's so much diversity and variety in crime fiction right now. Like you can read anything you want and write anything you want. And I just feel like there's a freedom now that's like a golden age in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. Yeah. And you also see, you know, not only are they allowing more different kinds of voices in finally,
right,
but there's also a nice infusion from different genres where it's not, you know, for instance, you know, horror, the horror genre is going through what I think is a very interesting transformation right now. You know, you got people like Stephen Graham Jones, you know, writing, you know, incorporating native folklore and tradition into his horror tales, and a lot of people that are kind of incorporating a different folklore. I find that fascinating, you know. So it's going through a good time.
Yeah, I feel like it's very liberating. It's like a time when like sort of a lot of barriers are down, and you're just like, okay, you feel like mixing horror with a procedural and setting it on a, you know, you know, in a world we haven't seen much of before, like go for it. And there'll be an audience for that. That's exciting to me.
Definitely. Let me see if I have any questions from our audience here. Robin says, no, it's not too late. Buy that bordello. Okay. I have to do that.
I may, Robin. I'm going to do it instead. I'm going to beat him to it. And I'm going to get a bordello.
Well, next time you're up, I've actually taken a couple of different writers out there. I took Wallace Strobe.
Oh, yeah, I know Wally.
Great, great writer.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Kind of under the radar. But we went out to Miami and Globe and looked at some of those old places. Let's see here. Yeah, I love the setting idea. I grew up in Kansas and we had Joyland as an amusement park. Looking forward to reading this.
Great.
Yeah. A couple of comments, just big fan of your work. So glad to see this book.
Great.
Let's see YouTube. Yeah. Have you sold the film rights or TV rights for it yet?
Well, not yet because of the writer strike. Right now, everything's kind of locked up a little bit. So I'm told there's good hope for it because I would love to see this. I think this would make a great feature or a great TV series. Really? But
it really would. Do you have any kind of casting ideas in your mind?
No, I'm weird that way. I wish I did, but once I write those characters, they are real to me, and I see them in my head as vividly as I see you right now, and so I can't picture anyone but the real Hardly. You know, that's how I think of him, the real Hardly, the real Eleanor. So,
right. Well, let's see. What are you reading these days? Anything?
I'm just started James McBride's new novel, which is, I loved, Deacon King Kong, I thought was a terrific novel, and I'm reading the new one. And I just finished Laurie Rader Day's novel, which is coming out in October. It's a mystery called The Death of Us, and it's terrific. Laurie's always so smart and digs so interestingly into complex characters and relationships. So I love that. Let's see. You caught me off guard. Okay, those are two off the top of my head. Oh, and I just did an event in Wichita with a book I really love with Angie Kim, Happiness Falls, which, again, talk about a crime novel that's like completely, you know, breaking down many boundaries, but it's still at heart a great mystery. Happiness Falls by Angie Kim is fantastic. So that's another one I've been reading.
We just did a big virtual event with her too, and she wrote Miracle Creek, right?
Yep. Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, she's great.
Well, Lou, it's been great visiting with you. We have a signing tonight with John Scalzi. So that should be fun.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. But congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much for the conversation. I mean, I love how we got into the weeds with some of this stuff. It's so much fun to talk about it in that way. So thank you.
There's a lot of stuff I wanted to go in deeper, but I realized that it would be spoiling things. So,
right.
But folks, you're in for a real treat with this book. As I said, we have signed copies. If you'd like to order one or pick up one wherever you purchase books. Is there a good audiobook?
Yes. The narrator is the guy who did November Road, and he's fantastic. Jonathan McLean.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. All right, Lou. Well, congrats again, and hope to
see you, Patrick,
in the desert soon.
I'll be there soon. I'll get that Bordello. Thank you very much.
Right on. Thank you.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.